Hello and welcome to a special edition of the In the Money Players podcast, our show for Sunday, September 12th, brought to you by BetMakers, the company helping introduce fixed odds horse racing betting into the United States. They sponsored that big day Thursday at Kentucky Downs, and they're sponsoring this podcast here for you today. We thank them for their continuing support. And to look at this late pick five, a stakes-laden late pick five on the Kentucky Downs card, we bring in two special guests. First off, from InTheMoneyPodcast.com, he's been doing great work over there covering Kentucky Downs. And yesterday, from a $20 entry to the Horse Player Happy Hour feeder, he just punched his ticket for a $10,000 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge seat. Michael Domable, congratulations. Nice hit.
Thanks, Pete. Excited to be here looking at the Sunday card. Kentucky Downs has been pretty kind over the past 6 days. I wish there was six more days there, but that's part of the beauty of it. Comes in and goes out just as fast.
It's true. It does, you know, make it special. That's for sure. The fleeting nature of this meet. And to talk about it, a man we often have on here talking about Naira, but talking about racing in his native state of Texas. But he'll talk about racing anywhere, basically, if they're running in a circle and turning left. Also from InTheMoneyPodcast.com, Nick Tamaro. Nick, how's your Kentucky Downs meet been going?
Going well. I didn't really dig in too much until a little bit last weekend and then yesterday, and I was on the gear jockey bandwagon. So it was a good result, good day, and I agree with Michael's sentiments. A lot of times at this meet, you feel like you could handle 5 or 6 days more, and then every time I look at a card, I think, well, you know, maybe not, because they're they're dense.
It's a lot of work.
There's a lot there, yeah.
It's kind of amazing how much work it is. I was bummed for whatever reason they didn't get the act together between their international simulcasting and the Brits. So I don't have it on the channel, which at first I was bummed about. But then going through these races and considering the type of work that, you know, one needs to do, I thought, you know what, maybe where we are in the calendar after the Marathon of Saratoga, maybe it's not so bad for me to take a little bit of a backseat, bet a few horses that leap off the page, and let guys like you do the real work. And for us today, the real work starts in race number six. We've got two-year-old maidens going on the turf, 6.5. And Michael, why don't we start with you? How do you want to kick this late pick five off?
Yeah, I don't think I have anything too clever to say for the first leg. It's, you know, there's a lot of two-year-olds in it, and a lot of firsters as well, so it's going to be important to watch the board, see if any of them are taking money. I thought the race would have been really interesting if some of those also eligibles would have got in, but I just checked the scratches, and they're all scratched. But I'm going to lean on the horses with experience in this spot, mainly because I found that at Kentucky Downs, in order for a firster to win, they really need to be coming from one of the barns that's known for that activity. So I'll really lean on the 9, Lemonade at the Latch, for Brad Cox. Was rained off in its first start at Ellis, but Brad's got good numbers, dirt to turf, with two-year-olds, 34%, 236 ROI. So I'll start off with Lemonade at the Latch, and then Faithful Ruler will be another use for me for Brendan Walsh. Ran okay last time out, and then probably just watching the board to see if any firsters take some money.
Yeah, that's a great thing about having this so early in the sequence. You have that opportunity to scout who might be taking money amongst those firsters. But 9 and 8 sound like the top line for Michael to get this pick five kicked off. Nick, how do you see it?
Yeah, I thought it was relatively wide open in addition to the couple of horses that Michael mentioned. There were a few pedigrees I thought that were a little interesting. Let My People Go on the rail is out of a turf winner. There are a couple of turf winners on the dam side. Horses that ran appreciably better on the turf than they did on the dirt. Of course, Vicky Oliver's numbers with horses moving to the turf are not very good. That's the big concern there. But I thought that he and I wanted to use Dowagiac Chief as well, because he just ran significantly better in his lone turf start than he did in either of those dirt starts, and now cuts back in distance with Luis Saez. So you figure he's going to be somewhat forwardly placed. And First Glimpse on the far outside for Mark Cassie. The dam was a multiple turf winner, and she's dropped a one horse to win on the turf, who again was a lot better on the turf than they were on dirt. So I was actually going to go relatively deep here and use the 1, 2, 8, 9, 12 as kind of my main horses, because I feel like the races where I kind of have an idea are a little bit later on. So that was my thought.
Fair enough. I'm going to list it as 1, 2, and 12 on the top line for you. And that's a really good point about, this is an angle we've seen working at the meet here with the two Dowagiac Chief, where you look at the pace figures the horse was running in a route race to the point of a sprint. And if you, you know, cherry pick that number from Timeform US, the two Dowagiac Chief could have an advantage against this crew. And you certainly like to see Sayas in the iron. So I'm particularly intrigued by that point. But it seems like a good race to spread it around a little bit. And just to recap, 9 and 8 for Michael. For Nick, I'm going to put him as 1, 2, 12 on the top line with 8 and 9 in the mix as well. Let's move on to race number 7. We've got stakes action now for these two-year-old fillies. 6.5 on the turf once again. 500,000 in the pot if you're eligible for the whole thing because of the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Nick, let's keep it with you.
Yeah, look, I think I've joked with you, Pete, before, and I've made enough morning lines to not want to give people that make morning lines a hard time because it's hard, especially in races like this. But I'll be absolutely stunned, even from the far outside, if Lady Danae is over 8-5 in this race. I mean, to me, she looks like, based on that debut, and as much as you can really dig into a debut performance and use it as a way to expect what's going to happen next time out, she ran really well in a race that's turned out to be, at least from the two recent runbacks late in the Saratoga meet, has turned out to be very productive. Those runbacks, of course, are Bubble Rock and Taurus. Taurus ran two turns on closing day, improved her Timeform US speed figure a point, but ran a race where she got into a little bit of trouble at the top of the stretch. Bubble Rock, of course, ran a vastly improved race and just ripped a maiden field apart on Friday of closing weekend. So Lady Danae is a horse I think that still has a ton of upside, and she's a single for me here. I really tried to entertain a number of alternatives. I think there's a great deal of speed between Take the Back Roads, Poppy Flower, Mystic Eyes, potentially even Awfully Fast, Koala Princess, JL's Rocket. I think that'll set up perfectly for a horse that did well coming from a little bit off the pace. And it just seemed to me like one where you're supposed to take the favorite and move on.
Michael, is it as simple as Lady Danae in this Ainsworth Stakes, race number 7 at Kentucky Downs?
Yeah, I like Nick's top pick as well. I think Lady Danae's probably the most likely winner. I wouldn't go as far to single just because I think there's some other interesting runners in here as well. I agree with what Nick was getting at, with that there are a lot of speed in this race. I mean, that's kind of typical of two-year-old stakes races with all of them breaking their maidens wire in the field. I think of the speed, the best of the speed will probably be Poppy Flower for me, number 8. Last time out was run down by a stablemate at Saratoga, so I think that form would transfer best out of the speed horses. One that's I'm trying to get a little too cute with, but I think is worth including is number 5 Cavalier Cupid coming up from Colonial. This runner's actually shown the ability to stalk and pounce, which I think will be beneficial in this field. And for my money, was one of the better 2-year-olds at the Colonial meet in general. And then the other one I would use as well, probably as primarily as a backup to Lady Danae, is Cheer Up Sleepy Jean. Not just because I'm a fan of the monkeys, but run that third at Royal Ascot, even though she was 50-1 that day, behind Quick Susie and Twilight Gleaming. Twilight Gleaming for War came back to win in France. So I think, and we just saw the Learjet run pretty well here yesterday. So I think that one could add a little bit of value as well if Lady Danae doesn't come back to her maiden win.
How would you grade those four runners you mentioned, Michael, into A's and B's?
I think I would go with the 12 as an the 12 as an A, and then the 5, 8, 11 as B's.
And, you know, in pop culture terms, I was getting a little bit worried about you when you told me you'd never seen The Sopranos, a topic we'll be talking about a little bit later in the show. But you've redeemed yourself with that monkeys comment, just in case you were wondering. Let's move on to race number 8. We stay in stakes. We've got 3-year-old fillies going 6.5 in the Nelson's Greenbrier Whiskey Music City Stakes. That's a mouthful. Michael, let's keep it with you. What do you like in here?
Yeah, I think this race, just like the one before it, there's a lot of speed signed on. I think it's got to set up for a closer. I think this race suits itself to a very likely winner in Toby's Heart. I think this distance, the about 6.5 furlongs of Kentucky Downs, where there's normally a pretty long run up, really suits itself to those horses that are tweeners like Toby's Heart is, where they're kind of equally proficient at sprints and routes. And I think that's the case here. You know, going back through his career, or through, let me make sure I get the gender right, through her career, you know, she was the talk of the town at Saratoga when she won that stakes. And then this year, she kind of had to bounce around between different distances. And I think a mile is really pushing it for her. And two back, and she didn't even run that poorly in either of those starts. Two back in the Teppan, Navratilova got to kind of walk on the front end, made a good rally into that. And then Technical Analysis is probably one of the best three-year-old fillies, turf fillies in the country. So no disgrace losing to her in the Lake George. So I think Toby's Heart's a very likely winner. And then the only two I would throw as probably distant backups would be Illegal Smile and Always Late coming out of the Galway. Illegal Smile kind of had to rally in on the inside of the eventual winner. And then Always Late was a big price that day and figures to be a big price again here, but kind of got her run stymied a little bit right as they were getting to the finish. So that's kind of how I see this event, with Toby's Heart pretty likely winner for me.
The 6 on the top line and the 7 and the 9 on the B line. I'll give you a little bit of on-air constructive criticism, because I've been called out on this as well. When you're in upstate New York, it ain't the Galway. It's the Galway. They yell at you. It's not quite whatever I once said about the stake race at Keeneland, but those upstaters, they'll let you hear about it. Nick, how do you see this one?
Yeah, I was going to bring up, this is like Appalachian versus Appalachian. Right? we've been corrected in the green room at Keeneland that it's the Appalachian. So I agree with Michael quite a bit that I think Toby's Heart's very much the one to beat. I think the cutback is going to do her just a ton of good. And I also agree that Navratilova, who really had the run of the race in the Teppan and didn't have much chance stalking Jouster in the Lake George, is going to be better sprinting as well. I just think Navratilova is more of a backup. Always Late is a backup for me. I'll probably just play Toby's Heart as a lone A and use the 5 and 9 as backups. I might throw in Pathetique also, the 2 for Phil Bauer, who improved off of a better debut than it looked on paper. Granted, is going to have to run significantly better, but this is a horse who might have a little bit of talent, and her odds are going to drift up quite a bit. So I thought she had a little bit of appeal to me. I agree with what Michael was saying about Always Late, and actually that Galway is worth watching the replay, because she got herself into contention in upper stretch. And, you know, that was a race with a full field, and the rail was at 27 feet, and the full field just kind of packed together right at the finish. And she was taken in hand at about the 16th pole and didn't really have a chance to run. So I think she could have more of an opportunity here. Unfortunately, she won't get the riding services of Jose Ortiz, who's 2 for 2 when riding her because he's off his mount. But she's a horse I think that definitely deserves some consideration.
Yeah, we do have one scratch in there. You can take out the 3, Puppy, Monkey, Baby, Pathetique. Very interesting. I mean, that 30-1 on the morning line, you get anywhere, you know, you get half of that. I mean, that seems like maybe not a bad place to go in a race that should be run to suit. And for those wondering, giving me a hard time because I punted on the pronunciation, Alcibiades. It's the Alcibiades, okay? I'm never making that mistake again. Race number 9 at Kentucky Downs on this Sunday card. Stakes once again, 3 and up fillies and mares going a mile and 5/16 in the Kentucky Downs Ladies Marathon. Very curious to hear what you guys have to say about this one. And Nick, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just being a little bit too simplistic with it. I didn't have anything really particularly clever to say. I thought the favorites and the principals on paper looked pretty tough, headed by Michelin and Luck Money. Look, I mean, the concern with Michelin, obviously, is that after a really good 2021 debut, she ran 3 really bad races. I mean, she was awful in the Jenny Wiley. And I think that the excuse clearly was that the turf was boggy, and it was very boggy. She was equally as bad in the Eatontown and Robert G. Dick. And so, you know, you like to see with a veteran horse them get a little bit of time, coming back, looks as if she's training well. Stidham won with Pixelate last week. He's good, generally good off of layoffs. Rosario's the right kind of fit. She's a winner over this course, actually at this trip. So it just feels like a time for kind of a restart for her. And that's what she's getting. I thought Luck Money ran arguably the best race two starts back. Delica, or she ran the second best race behind Delica, to be fair. But I think she ran better in the Glens Falls than it looks on paper. I tried to remind everybody that was very wowed by Warlike Goddess's performance. And not that Warlike Goddess didn't run well, but that was an enormous pace. And Glens Falls kind of made the first run at Delica to then capitulate and pass the baton to Warlike Goddess. So I think she actually ran very well that day. And I think the more around a mile and 5/16 is going to be better than a mile and 3/8 or a mile and a half. So I'm expecting Luck Money to run an improved race. The horses that I was unsure in terms of what to do, I'll be interested to see if Michael has better insight. But the Euro Shippers, La Lune and Isha My Flower, they look like they've been running against dramatically weaker horses than what they're facing here. Maybe not so much La Lune, but definitely Isha My Flower. I wondered distance-wise if this was the right kind of fit. So I was just going to kind of roll with those two, use the first of those two, La Lune, as a backup, as well as the 10 Blade Debbie.
Yeah, I think that I think La Lune definitely should be in the reckoning there as well. I don't blame you for taking a little bit of a question at the form when it comes to Isha My Flower. I mean, it's not form. We don't get a lot of Scando form over here. I don't really know what to make of it. But La Lune, based on that Group 3 Haydock run, I mean, this she's well spotted, and I like to see Connection shipping over for this meet. Pretty cool. And I'm certainly very excited to see how she gets on. But Michael, what about you? Who do you like in this one?
Yeah, I don't have either of the Euros in my play either. I took a hard look at La Lune. I didn't take as hard of a look at the Scandinavian form transferring over to Kentucky Downs. I think I'll let that one beat me the first time it happens. I was a little bit against Micheline. I think the last two starts are just too poor for me to take what could be a short price on. You know, you could give the excuse of the soft turf, but the race two back, she didn't really have any punch in the stretch. And I do think that it is a feather in her cap that she won over the course and distance last year, but I don't think she has that same liveliness in her form that she had when she was knocking heads with Harvey's Little Goyle last year. It would be fitting if Blame Debbie won this race, after being on the wrong end of what can only be considered a questionable disqualification at this meet last year. And that affinity for today's turf course will suit her well. But I'm not sure if she's really in the best form either. Her last two starts leave something to be desired. So I'm going to try to take a shot with Family Way for Brendan Walsh. He's at 17% with a 3.46 ROI over the last 5 years at Kentucky Downs. And I remember back a couple years ago, Pete, you had Mike Maloney on the show, and he was reluctant to give you that Brendan Walsh was one of his pet trainers at Kentucky Downs. And I've held that thought in my head for the last couple of years as well. And it's been pretty profitable. Her last race was on that prep day at Ellis. That's been pretty productive at the Kentucky Downs meet. She was actually facing boys that day. And that it featured a run where there were four horses in the lead pack that were contesting the pace, and she was the only one that stuck around to make out the trifecta. So Brendan Walsh coming off a 3-win day yesterday, Tyler Gaffer-Leone coming off a 3-win day yesterday, maybe a good stalking trip. And if she's able to navigate the 10.5 furlongs, I think she could spring the upset on the favorites.
So I'll pop the 7 as your A. Who did you want listed as backups? Did you want Blame Debbie in there, or Luck Money, or any of these others?
Yeah, I would put Blame Debbie as a B, as well as the 3 Flamingos as well for Cherie DeVoe. I think has got an outside chance.
Okay, big long shot there, 20-1 on the morning line for number 9. I think we're ready to kick on then and talk about this 10th race, which will conclude this pick 5. We've just got a starter allowance here, but interesting in that it's a mile and a half over this galloping turf. Michael, how are we going to get paid?
Yeah, this is a pretty cool race. I think it kind of got me to thinking about the closing race at the Oaklawn meet, the Trails End, mainly because Take Charge to Oro is in this one, who won that race a couple years ago. So it's kind of cool that they end with a nice long marathon going past the stands the first time. Take note that Artemis Eagle, the number 12, is going to be scratched. He ran yesterday in the Turf Cup. It was actually the morning line favorite. So I'm excited to see what we'll get from Vincent Van Gogh, who returns to the flat after alternating between that configuration and the hurdles the last three races, all of which were wins. He'll need to jump a few points on the buyer scale, but maybe Ray Lou can be forward with him in a race that kind of lacks early speed. Another one that's interesting to me is Time for Trouble, who really took a step forward when they stretched him out in distance last time at Belterra. And he's only a four-year-old, so he might have some more upside left in him than some of his rivals. And the Hiles Barn won a 12 furlong race at the meet already. But my top pick's going to be Zanesville, number six. He's had the unfortunate luck of six of his races being washed off the turf in his last 12. And I think he's just a much better turf horse, evidenced by the fact that he won this race at this level to close out the 2020 Kentucky Downs meet. And his last race looked a little bit better on paper at a distance probably short of his best. The top two runners ran 1-2 around the track at Indiana. And then George Leonard's been live this meet. Both runners hit the exacta, including a first-year that won at 28-1 that I couldn't have found with a telescope. So let's hope the history repeats itself and Zanesville can close out the Kentucky Downs meet.
Well, interesting case for sure. 6-4-8 for Michael on the top line to close things out. Nick, where are you?
Yeah, interesting race, no question about it. I actually thought that the two Jimmy D looked a little interesting, and I didn't, the horse that I thought was kind of in some ways the horse to beat that I didn't really know what to do with was the 10 Yamato, who's now stretching back out again for Murat Sankal, a second off a layoff after going a mile at Gulfstream. But his mile and a half effort against Bourbon in May back in March is, and obviously the mile and a half win at Gulfstream from December are good enough to win this race. So I kind of wanted those two as main horses. I thought Zanesville was a little interesting from off the pace as well. Felt like he'd be the right kind of long shot. Not that I can add anything really to what Michael said, but those were mainly the horses for me, 2 and 10. And I was going to back up with a little bit of the six and potentially the four. So it was a race where I thought you didn't have to be terribly deep, and it undoubtedly was very competitive on paper.
All right. Well, it's going to be fun to see how it plays out. Michael, thank you for your efforts. We're going to let you go and get on with your day. And we're going to keep Nick around for this little Easter egg that I've been planning for some time. But Godspeed, my friend. And we're going to have to get you, whether it's pre-recorded or live, we'll figure it out. You're going to have to guest on this week's Horse Player Happy Hour. That's a story I want to tell, putting up $20 and ending up with a $10,000 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge seat. You think we can get that arranged?
Yeah, we'll make it work. We'll get our set schedule synced. Excited. Thanks for having me on today. And Nick, great to join you as well. Big fan of yours.
Absolutely. Thank you. Big fan of yours too.
Good stuff. All right, Michael, we'll catch up with you this week. Nick, it's time to talk about this long delayed Sopranos story. It's gone by a few different names. I love the one that it's ended up with, The Many Saints of Newark, which for the uninitiated, the unfamiliar with Sopranos history and or the Italian language, Many Saints, Moltisanti, as in Christopher Moltisanti. And it seems like the Moltisanti family and its tie-ins with the Sopranos family are going to be very much at the heart of this new film based on what we've seen so far. We've had two trailers now. They've had kind of different tones. What is your general impression of them before we get down to brass tacks?
Yeah, it's gonna be great. I mean, I'm very much looking forward to it. And I was reading a Rolling Stone article yesterday, actually before you and I talked about this, because I found myself sitting in my office at home and watching old Sopranos episodes because it's something easy to have on in the TV overhead and keep working. And so I found an article that sort of said these are the episodes you want to watch before you watch Many Saints of Newark.
And ooh,
so,
cool.
Yeah, so it was, I'll send you the link. It's actually,
yeah, I'd love to see that. Yeah. I was considering a complete rewatch, but if we run out of time, yeah, let's link to that in the description too. So yeah, do send me that.
Yeah, definitely. And so I think it's, what I think they're trying to do is make sure that you understand how to set the stage for what we're going to be watching in this. And so, you know, everybody that I think understands what a prequel is that, you know, the characters are going to be, the character names are going to be the same. The people are going to be completely different. And it's going to be very heavy on Dickie Moltisanti, who Tony Soprano makes multiple references to throughout the series and is basically the reason why he takes such an active role in Christopher Moltisanti's life because of his affinity for Uncle Dickie, as he refers to him. And that's part of the reason why he refers to Christopher as his nephew. So there are references from, you know, when they're talking about Johnny Boy Soprano shooting a bullet through the beehive hairdo of Livia in an episode like Soprano Home Movies. And, you know, when Tony and Carmela are in the aftermath of an enormous argument in Whitecaps, he says to her, how did you not realize there were going to be women on the side? You grew up with around Dickie Moltisanti, you know, and so he becomes sort of a, there are multiple people throughout the series that become kind of a crutch for Tony, or people that they often reference. One of them is Gary Cooper, of course, and the other one is Dickie Moltisanti. And so he, so it's going to be very heavy on Dickie Moltisanti. I'm incredibly intrigued, and I think that it's just an incredible job of casting to use Vera Farmiga as Livia. And the images I've seen really make you feel like that looked like a young Livia.
Dude, there must be prosthetics, right? I mean, she looks exactly like
her. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I don't have confirmation on that, but that's my guess, is that they're like they're taking some liberties, because it totally uncanny and seems to have the voice down, and obviously that relationship that's so at the heart of The Sopranos, Tony and his mom, is going to also be at the center of this thing. Let's talk about the actor. What do you know about the actor who's playing Dickie Moltisanti? It seems like a pretty interesting choice of casting. And, you know, we see those scenes that sort of anchor that first trailer, well, actually both trailers, with him and Ray Liotta. But where do you know Alessandro Nivola? Do you know where he's from?
I don't. I was actually looking, trying to find a little bit more information. I don't know really anything about him. I don't know if he's relatively new, or I found that he's American. As far as past acting roles, I think that he's had a pretty limited run. So I was actually looking at what I recognized that he was in. I mean, very, very little. He was, I, you know what? I actually did find something. So he played... He was in American Hustle. He played the FBI boss, the attorney. I guess he was the U.S. attorney, and so he played Anthony Amato, the U.S. attorney in there. So he's actually had a pretty long, pretty decent sized career so far.
It reminds me a little bit of Gandolfini, you know, pre-Sopranos, like an actor who's been working for a long time, has a ton of stage presence screen presence, I guess we should say, and charisma. But, you know, sometimes it's much better for a role, you know, a central role like this in an iconic franchise, to bring somebody in who we don't have these pre-associations with. So I thought it was interesting. And then, of course, you can't talk about this trailer, you can't talk about this movie without talking about the casting of young Tony, and you want to talk about something that's just crazy to see is the young Gandolfini, who has, you know, a handful of credits himself, but playing this role, that must just be the ultimate mental jujitsu for him to get into this character. But I mean, I have to say, just based on the trailers, he's got it down. Like, this is going to work.
It really looks that way, right? I mean, he turns and somebody says something to him in the trailer, and he's standing by the phone booth, and he turns around and he says, "What did you say?" And you look at that face and you're like, "Oh my God, if that's not, you know, if that's not baby Tony, I don't know what is." That may have been something that worked out just perfectly in terms of how things went. Because I mean, you're clearly not going to find a better young version. And, you know, the only glimpse, one of the episodes in this Rolling Stone article I referenced before that they talked about was an episode called In Camelot, where Tony sort of surreptitiously runs into his father's mistress. And they end up having, you know, basically an episode long relationship where they speak to each other numerous times, and he helps her get some money back from a auto track that Johnny Boy Soprano had promised her, and then she didn't get anything. And there's a scene in it where they're referencing, and it's actually when Tony sort of starts to lose any interest in being around her. First of all, when he finds out that she was smoking around his father while he had emphysema. And second of all, more so when he remembers that he lied on his father's behalf when his mother was in the hospital with a miscarriage. And so they show teenage Tony, and he has long hair, and he tells Livia that they were at Cousin Jimmy's. And so they definitely used, I think that was probably one of the only images of teenage Tony. You saw child Tony quite a bit. Yeah. But that was one of the only ones. And so they definitely used that as a guide for how they were going to make Michael Gandolfini look. And I think it works perfectly, because he has, you know, his hair is about the same length, and it looks to be, It looks as if everything that was done during the series was packaged up perfectly to put it in a big screen format.
What kind of a journey do you expect we're going to see? I mean, the first trailer and the second trailer, the Tony journey looked like, it, for me, in the second trailer, is going to be like a little bit more sophisticated. In the first trailer, we see him, oh, I can't get involved with this. I'm supposed to go to college. And it seemed like it was just going to be, you know, some type of fallen, you know, angel arc routine, how, you know, just your typical almost like comic book creation myth. But I felt like that got really complicated in an interesting way in the second trailer. What do you think we're going to see in terms of Tony's arc?
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to be the story of Tony Soprano in The Sopranos is one of the greatest stories of good and evil. And the, to me, the best example of a hero villain that you'll ever find in entertainment, period. Because here was a guy who you interchangeably saw as sympathetic and as sociopathic, and that could often happen in a 15-minute period. You know, you could see him as somebody that you wanted to sit down and have dinner with, and then a few minutes later, you could see him as somebody that you would never want to be anywhere near. You know, and so I think that it's going to be a little bit of, yeah, I mean, he's a smart guy in terms of he's obviously very clever, as most people in that life are. And he was supposed to be a college guy, right? I mean, we hear a lot about the semester and a half at Seton Hall that he was supposed to continue on. And so, you know, I think the one thing that David Chase probably had to kind of rectify was that throughout the series, they made different references to what Tony's life was going to be about before he got into the life, so to speak. And, you know, and one of them was when he saw his father cut off Mr. Satriali's pinky, and he was young at that point. So he knew that, you know, Johnny Boy did not have a desk job. He did not have a 9-to-5 job where things were squeaky clean. So he was brought into the life probably a little bit earlier. And so I think it's going to be about how he got into it in a lot of ways, despite not supposing to get into it. And one of the things that was done so well in the series that obviously won't be referenced in here because you're dealing with a young Tony was that, you know, Tony sees in his own son, Anthony, in the show that obviously he's nothing like him and he's never going to be involved in that kind of life because he's just not capable of it. So it's going to be the difference between how a, you know, father and son interact with each other when they know that they do have that common ground. Cause I think that's going to be a pretty much a central point of all of this movie.
And planting the seed of the Christopher relationship that obviously that the way that wins and turns throughout the season. They got into that very much on the nose with one scene in particular in the second trailer. And I'm very interested to see how that plays out as well. I mean, I'm dreaming that, you know, we're going to avoid. It's so hard when you're doing this kind of a prequel to be too on the nose, but to like feather in the references and inflection points to just give even a richer subtext to this already great work of art. That's The Sopranos. In the hands of somebody else, I'm not sure. I think it could be done. I'd be worried. In the hands of David Chase, I'm kind of dying to see it. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, totally agree. Yeah. And you know, I think that now, you know, there are a couple of episodes and there are a couple of references made along the way where it was probably a bit of a long play for David Chase. And it probably crossed his mind that, you know, this could actually be a potential movie down the line. And one of them was, and it was a little awkward. It was the season premiere of season 4, where at the end of the episode, Tony takes Christopher to a location where the guy who killed his father is inside because he had just celebrated his retirement, and Christopher ends up going in and, you know, exacting a little revenge, which when you're a Sopranos fan, you root for things like that to happen. You forget that that's actually somebody killing someone else. But so, you know, I think that was where I think the show is so brilliantly done, and people don't, they know that we both love it so much. They don't have to hear terribly much more about it, but you know, that using the Dickie Moltisanti character in so many different ways and so carefully and so perfectly and referencing him, you know, just enough to keep him in the mix. This is a great example of it, right? Because we get a little insight into who he was, what he meant to Tony, and obviously what he means to Christopher. And Christopher and Tony have the most loving, tortured relationship you could possibly have. And, you know, and that I didn't realize until I watched it, I don't know, probably for the 10th time, that Uncle Junior sort of the two people that Uncle Junior has it out for right from the start that he has virtually nothing nice to say about are Janice and Christopher. And he tells Tony early on that a person in a crew that has a drug problem is like a sick dog and you can't have them around. And so, you know, Tony's seeds of doubt with Christopher start early on. And then they have these moments along the way that shows his affinity for Christopher almost. And we're going to see, I guess, that juxtaposed against Tony's relationship with Dickie that I think is foreshadowed to be in kind of a similar fashion. But without some of the distaste that Christopher has, that Tony has for Christopher, that, let's not kid ourselves, is much deserved.
Well, that's a whole other topic, and I can't wait to see how the seeds are planted in Many Saints of Newark. You mentioned Uncle Junior, one of the more familiar actors in the trailers. I didn't recognize because he looks so much like, not unlike what we were talking about with Livia, Uncle Junior, played by Corey Stoll, looks very much like a young Uncle Junior and not so much like Corey Stoll, at least in what we see. But I thought that was some very interesting casting. And it makes me think, just based on Corey Stoll and you know, his immense credits in the Marvel Universe and, House of Cards and on Billions, it makes me think that he's going to have a bigger role than we're seeing in the trailer just because it's him. Did the Rolling Stone article touch on this? Have you heard anything or read anything, or do you accept that hypothesis at all?
No, I think you're exactly right. Yeah. I think that makes perfect sense. I can't wait to see how he is sort of woven into the storyline, you know, what it all sort of involves. But yeah, he looks like a very, very much a young version of Corrado Soprano. We see one glimpse of Corrado early on when I think he and Johnny Boy in the series, of course, when he and Johnny Boy are trying to grab somebody that owes them money. And he has those, you know, old fashioned wire rim glasses. And I think he'll have probably kind of a similar look. So that seemed like a no-brainer casting wise, and one where Corey Stoll benefited from being a little follically challenged. So I noticed also that Paulie Walnuts is going to have some appearances. He's played by Billy Magnuson, who's kind of a young guy that's had a couple of brief roles. I remembered him most vividly from having a bit role in The Big Short. So he's a guy that's who's right. been in a few movies. He played one of those two dipshits in The Big Short that they run into that are just pimping out horrible mortgages. And and he's had a few, you know, nothing big. Again, I'll be interested to see what, you know, Paulie is the only character. There's also a character that's playing a young Silvio Dante as well. Yep. And so I'm going to be interested to see how that works out as well, because Paulie is a character that, you know, you forget sometimes watching the show, basically predates the show itself, you know, by a distance. He goes back to the Johnny Soprano era. And one of the episodes that Rolling Stone mentions to watch is Remember When, which is where Paulie tells a story about him and Johnny Boy Soprano driving back from, I think it was South Carolina, or maybe it was even Florida. And he tells a story about how, you know, he spends the whole episode, as the article says, blathering on about the old days. And Tony delivers one of the greatest lines of all time, which, you know, when Paulie asks him why he's being so quiet, he says, "Remember when is the lowest form of conversation." So, which is just a phenomenal line.
Oh, and, it's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. And so anyway, so he gives kind of a glimpse into what, you know, young Paulie was like and what his relationship with Johnny Boy was like. So it's great. I mean, it's you know, it's basically going to be 2 hours worth of building on these little stories that we heard along the way. So I can't wait. I mean, it's going to be tremendous. It's long awaited.
You can pick through the trailer and identify the whole crew, basically. It'll be interesting to see how much screen time everybody gets. I mean, we're coming from a universe that had all these hours to tell all these stories, and here we've got 2 hours and all these characters we want to see more of. But perhaps that's why this is subtitled A Sopranos Story, with the suggestion that if this works out, that there could be more of them. Have we heard anything about that? I mean, David Chase, not exactly known for being the fastest worker, and he doesn't seem somebody who'd be up for Marvel style parsing out the franchise and putting himself in a central role. But I mean, I can pretty much tell you right now, I'm going to want to see more here than what we're going to be allotted.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he may be getting a little long in the tooth in terms of wanting to do, you know, much more of this. But look, I mean, there's going to be a Michael Gandolfini's only going to get a little older and is probably only going to continue to look like his father. So there's going to be a huge opportunity there. And now that you have, yeah, basically now that the band is back together with a young version of who all those people are, there could be another opportunity. And, you know, that was one thing. The Sopranos, what's one of the interesting things about The Sopranos is that a lot of storylines throughout the series were touched on and then they really weren't finished. And one of the storylines that the show began with is that, you know, Tony never really became the boss. You know, Junior was the boss the entire way. And, you know, we saw a couple of times during the series where the New York crew had a new boss come in and there was like a ceremony, you know, there was a celebration. I mean, I think Nancy Sinatra came and sang to Phil Leotardo when he became the boss of the New York family. Right. And so Tony never really got that because Junior was always the acting boss, but he was dealing with his legal problems. So, you know, how did it get to the point where Jackie Aprile was the boss and Tony ended up sort of assuming the day-to-day roles of it? He was the one that they, you know, kicked up the money to, so on and so forth. And there is a lot of storyline there, you know, how the DeMeo crime family kind of developed and what was the relationship with the New York captains and crew like, because, you know, Carmine Lupertazzi always joked about how Jersey was a glorified crew, not a family. So yeah, I mean, it would be, hell, I think if they give you and I enough time, we might be able to write the damn thing for wherever this movie ends and the show starts. So there's a lot of opportunity there.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, but who knows? Maybe we'll get to tell enough stories that we'll eventually figure out whatever happened to the Russian and the Pine Barrens. What do you think?
I mean, isn't that the greatest untouched storyline of all time? It's you know, everybody in the world that was an avid, and did you watch Weekly at that point in time?
You know, I came to it late just because where I was running around and having HBO, I actually binge watched Sopranos after it was over, if you can believe that.
Okay. Yeah, no, I totally can. I mean, my history with the Sopranos goes back to my father telling my mother and I eating dinner in 1998, hey, I saw a preview for what looks like a really good show on HBO. And we watched the pilot together in January. And then the next episode came out in April. So, I mean, we watched Weekly. I didn't, even in college, I didn't miss one. But my parents were out that night, the night that the Pine Barrens episode came out, and I had broken my ankle. And so I was at home and I watched the episode and they came home from the function that they were at. And my dad was like, was the episode good? And I'm like, I said, Dad, it was the best episode that's ever been. And he's like, really? I said, yeah. And so we had TiVo at that point in time. And so we rewound the TiVo and sat and watched it. And, you know, the next 6 days, basically, you were waiting for the next episode to see what happened with the Russian. And he never got brought up again. Right? I mean, he just never came. There were references made to it. And Paulie and Christopher argued about it subsequently. But, you know, we never knew what happened. You know, you almost wondered sometimes watching it if he was going to come roaring into the bada bing and, you know, exact his revenge. So, yeah, that was one of the things. And you know, that was why the ending to a Sopranos fan was never really that surprising, because David Chase did whatever the hell he wanted in this show. I mean, there were no rules. There was no, you know, in a way there was no, and I don't mean it in a negative way, but there was no plan. You know, there was nothing. He had four different endings. He chose one, didn't tell anybody what it was. And that was it.
Yeah. I mean, there was no fan service, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
This is not a man to compromise for his art. And you might not have liked every element of it, you know, Tony's Dante-esque journey or you know, some of the other controversial subplots along the way, certainly the ending, certainly Pine Barrens. But to me, he's just one of the things that makes Chase great is his, you know, how tuned in to the human condition he is and just how uncompromising he is in his artistic vision. I think we're going to see that on display in The Many Saints of Newark as well. Can't end this conversation, though, without talking about one of the big questions to come out of the trailer and one of the great just hey moments when you see the trailers. Ray Liotta's appearance coming from prison is the simplistic idea that that's Dickie Moltisanti's father? Like, who is this character? Is this a known thing, or is it a known unknown? Is it an unknown unknown? What do you know, and what can you tell us about Ray Liotta's involvement in Many Saints of Newark?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be something we kind of have to figure out, because it doesn't seem clear. So I'm very interested. I think he's Dickie Moltisanti's father. So he's obviously going to have some of the, you know, I don't know, boss capo related elements to him. Obviously, you know, people that have watched the series and that are listening to this are going to know that traditional Italian families, not much different than a lot of other cultures, elders are always shown more respect. And that's the case here. So, and then in a crime family, you know, the boss is everything. So, yeah, I think we'll see a little bit of how that goes. There are a lot of references made throughout the series to people who are in prison and have had their, you know, status changed in the family because of that. So, yeah, I'm going to be very intrigued by how they use him. And gosh, I mean, Ray Liotta, you know, somebody that's had an incredible career. And you know, one of the more interesting, obviously it's also fun because there are a lot of little subtle references made in the show to Goodfellas, and Ray Liotta is sort of the face of Goodfellas, right? Along with, sure, with Robert De Niro. So in fact, I mean, and I think I know you and I have talked about it, but there's a scene in the first season of Sopranos when Christopher sort of loses it and he shoots the clerk at the bakery in the foot, and Christopher, of course, famously being Spider from Goodfellas, and the clerk says to him, "You shot me in my foot." And he looks at him and he goes, "It happens." And he turns around and walks out. And it's like a great reference to...
Very sly.
Exactly. So it's kind of perfect that Liotta is in here, you know, especially now that his career has become... I mean, he's had a lot of different things go on, and I think he's been great in everything, but he is going through a little bit of that late in his career. You know, where do I fit now? Because I can't always play a tough guy in my mid-60s.
Yes, it was wonderful to see him, and I'm super excited to see how it all plays out. So October 1st, 2021, I think I know where you'll be. I definitely know where I'll be, hoping to get to see this, you know, in one of the first available shows. I don't think tickets are on sale anywhere yet. It will be on HBO Max, I guess, a month after the release. It's been a long wait, man. I think this was originally a fall of 2020 situation. We've had to wait a long time. You and I both think it's going to be worth the wait. What do you say after we see the sucker, we hop back on here and chat about it some more?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm very much planning on that. So that's the schedule. I know David Chase is pissed about the HBO Max part of it. He
wants a longer window.
He wanted big screen. Yeah, I think he wanted big screen for only, or big screen mainly, for as long as possible. I read an article about that the other day. So, yeah,
perhaps that's still up for debate. But at least a month, from what I'm seeing, it's going to be theaters only. I want to see it in theaters. You know, I mean, it was always very cinematic, even on the small screen. But I just think it's an event, you know, yeah, in a day when, you know, there's plenty of great entertainment properties out there and whatnot. But like, for me, in terms of anticipation, I can't even think what the last thing I'll have wanted to see, you know, this much in the theater before, and with the hype of, you know, waiting for it for multiple years.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I mean, I've not been looking forward to one like this, gosh, in a very, very long time.
Great stuff, Nick. Thank you for your thoughts on Many Saints of Newark and Kentucky Downs. We do it all here. Michael Domable had a funny line. He suspected that the Venn diagram between our horse racing audience and people interested in The Sopranos was a near circle. He just wasn't part of it, as somebody who hadn't seen. But, you know, and what? When he told me that, I made fun of him before about it, but I secretly envied him to have the ability to watch The Sopranos for the first time ahead, as an experience ahead of him instead of behind him, the way that we do. I actually kind of envied that, but he better get on the ball and go, because you know, if you want to see Many Saints of Newark, you better get going on that full rewatch. I think I'm going to go ahead and follow this Rolling Stone plan and selectively watch these episodes a little bit more realistic with only 3 weeks to come. But really appreciate your time today, my man, and we'll do it again soon.
You bet. Absolutely enjoyed it, as always. Take care.
All right. Great stuff from Nick. Great stuff from Michael. Really appreciate everybody out there in the audience as well. keep those comments coming. Let us know if you like this entertainment content, by the way. We've had good reactions when we've done weird little flyers like this before, but you know, we're all about serving you, the audience. So holler at us and let us know what you think. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kitchen. I'm Peter Thomas for Natal. May you win all your photos.